welcome to day two of Stanza 2009. On this podcast, our first full day, we've got excerpts from this year's Stanza discussion, where Kate Clancy, Thomas A. Clarke, David Mach, Peter McCary, and Stephen Scobie explore Scottish identity and homecoming within the context of the nation's poetic heritage. We've also got a reading from Stephen Scobie's new collection, Robert Louis Stevenson from World's End, and a few kind words from poets Robert Crawford and Kate Clancy about Stanza. And we'll kick things off with excerpts from this year's Stanza discussion. This concerns one of Stanza's themes this year, homecoming, and we invited the participants to explore Scottish identity and the notion of homecoming, which is one of Stanza's two themes this year. We start with poet Kate Clancy.
Well, to speak about Scottishness and my writing, I find it quite an emotional topic because my Scottishness or my Englishness and how much I'm allowed to say, the idea of raising my voice, are very intimately connected for me, because I have an English father and a Scottish mother, and I lived all my life until I was 20 in Scotland. Nevertheless, I was always identified as English, as having an English voice. And when I was growing up in Glasgow in the 70s, that was enough to be told to shut up all the time. Shut up, shut up, shut up, you're English. That's what I was always told. And when I think about what is the thing that makes me the kind of loud, gregarious, very sociable person, what's the thing that turns me inward to make my speech start to form patterns inside my head? What's the thing that makes me a writer? I think all writers are bullied at school, but my bullying at school has got that name on it. You're English, be quiet. But I think it's perhaps fair to say that Glasgow in the 70s had a lot of settled hate in it. And also, I mean, English was quite a big catch-all. It's like when I taught in schools in England, people, you know, gay meant learning languages, good at English. Almost anything can make you gay. And English was a kind of similar infection. I think being tall, being a bit loud, going on a CND demonstration, almost anything. People talk about English tolerance, and English working people, I think, are very tolerant. Nobody is asked to tolerate more difference than the people of the East End of London. And sometimes that tolerance is indifference. Sometimes it's too much difference and nobody cares anymore. And sometimes it's tolerance. So I would say England says you can write whatever you want. You can say whatever you want. Nobody's going to laugh at your voice. So if Scotland turns you in, and England gave me the chance to actually say things, even if they didn't give the impression they were listening all the time.
Then it was Thomas A. Clarke's turn.
In contrast to a big word like homecoming, I'd always prefer to use a more modest phrase, for instance, coming home. And when I think about coming home, I think about turning in at a certain gate, about coming back to my favourite armchair, finding the slippers where I left them, and so on. I guess what I'm trying to say about homecoming is we should be wary that it doesn't become some kind of slogan and that this emptiness of content isn't filled with the wrong content, that it's not hijacked by notions of blood and soil and so on. But while coming home is a legitimate and beautiful theme for poems, I'd also say that poetry is on the side of leaving, that poetry itself is a setting out. If you remember all those old songs and stories that begin with the phrase, "As I walked out one morning," that seems to me the true spirit of poetry. Another way of saying that would be that neither the poet nor the reader should know at the beginning of a poem where it will take them. If there's not some discovery to be made along the way, then a poem will remain inert on the page. Rather than a poetry of homecoming that returns to the familiar and the known, I'm for a poetry of adventure and discovery. So I prefer the idea of the poet as a shape changer, and indeed that any reader who enters imaginatively into the poem is also a shape changer. When you read a poem or listen to a poem, who are you? Where are you? It doesn't really make sense to say that you're sitting in your chair, that you're still in charge of your own project. On the contrary, you've actually ditched all that altogether. You are at that moment elsewhere in the place of the poem, and you're taking on the shapes and colours of the images and phrases. At that point, I would say that poetry is therefore an ecstatic art in the true sense of that word. It offers you an out-of-the-body experience. And to try and kind of gather all that and cram it in again to some sense of identity, Scottish or otherwise, seems to me a great reduction. It's to drastically diminish something that is large and bright and potentially boundless. Homecoming is coming back to where you started from. Identity is returning to who you are or who you take yourself to be.
It was then sculptor David Mach's turn.
I find myself being terribly excited to be Scottish all the time. I love being Scottish. It's like some sort of strange blessing that I didn't earn at all. You know, it was given to me. You know, and I mean, somebody asked me once, tell me something about your work. What's the best thing about your work, your sculpture? What's the thing you like the best? I said, well, it seems to be irritating. You know, it irritates folk. And they just got to look at you like, you know, you don't mean it. No, I really do mean it. It really does irritate a lot of people, you know. And I really quite like that. And being Scottish is that there's a kind of, you have a kind of dual thing, like some huge sort of shiny badge. You know, yes, I'm Scottish, you know, you're not English. We're all desperately, you know, we don't want to be seen to be English, I'm definitely Scottish. You know? And I'm a bit of a puzzle, I think, because my father was Polish, very Polish, and very eccentric. And I spent a good part of my time going backwards and forwards to Poland, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm really happy to have that kind of Polish side as well. I mean, in fact, a third of the family are Czech, because where he comes from is split into two, right on the Polish border, you know. So I'd have this weird life where we'd be in Fife, we'd be in Poland, and we'd be in Glasgow, where my mum's from. And my mother was also very eccentric. This is a woman who was sold in a pub to my granddad. I had this kind of weird kind of take on all sorts of things. So I was brought up with all this great eccentricity, and I'd listen to my dad lying to somebody just for the hell of it, just to see what it sounded like, you know? And you know, because he was, it's that question of identity thing. You know, you meet somebody and you instantly start to try and think, well, what's that person like and what do they think of me? And you're reading them, and they're reading you at the same time, and they're making a mistake. You think I'm a something or other. I'm not, you know. But you send all these kind of signals and red herrings and messages. My dad was an expert at that. He would just lie to people. He'd say outrageous things, you know. And as a kid, I'd be really worried about it. I'd think, God, this is. I'd go, Dad, it's just really embarrassing. But in the end, I used to love introducing my dad to people just to see how the hell.
Peter McCary decided that he would read a poem to illustrate his views.
Okay, so the Art of Memory. Two gods are at the door for you. I went outside. The agora was Buster Keaton round me, just two pillars from the temple to the horseman and the boxer. Twins this Church of Paul is clinging to like faith are left. Old Menico Scarlatti blacking out, and no score to consult, but a polis file of stolen goods recovered. For Naples has forgotten more than what it is to starve, and what it is, like the song of songbirds in tiny cages, that sage or salvia in pots at kitchen windows, of hill villages that squat the hanging gardens of villas double-parked alongside Byzantine and Gothic crypts, in seismic streets and avenues, where messengers and vespas, who've lost their cool, their suave, their messages, from Ladislao d'Angelo Durazzo, say, to Belisarius, secretes. That brings to mind both mint and grapefruit. Now, what's Scottish about that? I wrote it. And what's Scottish about me? Not a lot, if you look, because all my forebears were Irish peasants. My family, they wouldn't have spoken English. My grandparents spoke good Glasgow Scots, and we were told not to speak like our grandparents. My children speak other languages again, so we're sort of passing through.
And to finish off this exploration, Stephen Scobie also composed a poem.
So this is called St. Andrew's Day. And then there was Andrew, Andy, the younger brother, who always had to cope with Peter, named as the Rock, the one who was given the key to the kingdom. Unfair, in Andrew's opinion. Who was it betrayed the Lord three times in the premonitory Scottish cold of that night in the garden? Not me. Andrew kept drifting east, while Peter drove direct to the brutal western fatality of Rome. And his brother, sailing to Byzantium, casting his net into the Black Sea, mouth of the Volga, clear to Kiev. Then returning to Greece and trying to preach the risen Christ to the third sophisticated century of Aristotle's pupils. So they stretched him on a cross in Patras, heeding his modest request that it not be shaped like his master's, but rather an X, like a poor man's illiterate signature. And then his bones, scattered across the Christian world, one finger to the Pope. And in a dream, the monk called Regulus, or Rule, instructed to carry them as far as the limit of knowledge, Scotland's cold shore, the saint's day to be celebrated by the onset of winter storms, when the hard North Sea beats its waves on those exposed long sands and on the city that bears his name, St. Andrew's. Tell me, old bundle of bones, Andrew in your hodden grey, Andrew in your compulsive revelation, how would you see our city now, on its long, on its grey, on its most un-Galilean sea?
Thanks to all the participants in what was a really stimulating and interesting event. And now we have Stephen Scobie reading from his new collection about Robert Louis Stevenson. It's over to Stephen.
I'm going to be reading from this book, which is wet off the press. It's called Robert Louis Stevenson at the World's End. And it's a quasi-biography of Stevenson done in ostensibly his own voice, although his own voice is deeply infected with my voice. So it's as if there are two presences within one voice, which is a good Stevensonian theme. I'm going to start with this poem, and two things you need to know. Smout was a childhood nickname for Lewis, and Cummy, as many people know, is the nickname for Alison Cunningham, his childhood nurse, to whom A Child's Garden of Verses is dedicated. Under the red sky, smout lies discarded, greeting like Columba's horse, until Cummy comes to hold me tight inside her grasp of hellfire and reluctant heaven. Stories screaming through all my childhood years of sleepless nights, my coughing hours, and dim Presbyterian dreams. Edinburgh evenings, a sickly child's
burden of verses. Verses, weeds, thistles, stinging nettles, rank undergrowth of dock and fern, everywhere bad children go, who do not have the luxury of great fathers, rich fathers, those who build, who bring their light to the scatter of storms, angry on our ragged edge of a marginal country, kidnapped Scotland. I don't want to go to hell. I don't want to go to hell. It's very simple. Camille tells me I don't want to go to hell. Be a good boy like a Christian. Be a good boy. Camille tells me, be a good boy, go to hell. Camille tells me, very simple, like a Christian, I don't want to say my prayers. Camille tells me, night is falling, I don't want to. Very simple, go to hell, say my prayers, I don't want to. Camille tells me, night is falling, say my prayers, go to hell. Despite Camille's influence, Lewis developed some rather alarming free-thinking tendencies. And in 1873, had a violent quarrel and estrangement with his very devout Presbyterian father. This is my idea of his response. My father, who art not in heaven, continue to be thy name. May your lighthouses shine according to your blueprints on the stormy swept reef as on the shifting sand. Give me my measly monthly allowance and pay all my debts as I incur new ones. Be horrified by my temptations and pray intently for my straying soul. For Harriet Rowe belongs to you, the family firm and the family name. At least for now. Amen. I'd say that in Scotland, the weather is never small talk. A fine forenoon is a grave considered amelioration. Miserable times we're having implies we deserve them and must passively tolerate meteorological judgment. A fine day, is it not, includes the possibility of not. But when the sun grants a hesitant embrace, then the old stones of Riki soak in its warmth and hod it down, even in cellars and in winding stairs, letting it go in grudging January or capricious April, till a boy and a girl huddle in Prince's Street Gardens, telling each other small talk, warm for the time of year, and cuddle closer into the promise of the cold and lucid northern light. What are we Scots? We're scarcely a single nation, living in yoke, highland and lowland, Saxon and Gael. Under Her Gracious Majesty, that sad and lonely woman who would rather be a German countess. Our history divides us rather than unites us. It was none other than ourselves, in our best dress uniforms, who hunted our prince through the heather into his alcoholic grave. God rest his haunted songs and his stubborn soul. But the one trait we can always find to share is our long and absolute disdain of England, foreign nation. Pallid tongue. I know that people say, I am of my age the greatest English stylist. But I would say I am a stylist, whatever that may mean, in English, not of it. I write it always as a foreign tongue, hiding in its elegant precision, while the unregenerate Scot in me stumbles through that bloody heather, pechen and sweeten, disjasket for fuchen and brundaf. That last line comes from Robert Garrick, the 1950s Edinburgh poet. My Stevenson is clairvoyant. He sees a lot of things that haven't yet happened. As in this poem. May the good Lord gang wi ye and keep ye peace. May his troubled grace let fall slow countenance upon ye. The dern face of a dowie lord shine blessings on ye. And on your kirt, and on your dug, and on your wee bit clerty cat that sleeps awa' her lee lang hours afore your silent television. One of Stevenson's first great successes was, of course, Travels with a Donkey in the Savannah. I might as well be shoving a donkey's arse up some French mountain road as trying to tell you this, dear reader, I care about you. I care how well you're feeling. I care whether you had a decent breakfast. I care about what you're wearing. Does that waistcoat really suit you? Is there a bright and sufficient light that sheds on my page? Are you rubbing your eyes out of weariness or bleared displeasure? Are you sitting down in your easy chair? The road to the top of this mountain is long and dusty, smeared by sun. The donkey, by its nature, is recalcitrant. It's a long, hard climb to the bottom of this page. And then we get into Treasure Island. Lays the black spot on Billy Bones, image of his deadlight eye, blind pew. Comes stumbling up the stony path. The way up and the way down are one and the same. Into the story. Following the map I idly drew. And I too followed to the secret place of burial, which of course proved empty. No one there to receive the stigmata. Bones and pew and all Flint's crew scattered to memories. Only the sea cook left, the seafaring man with one leg, barbecue. And someone tells me he's gone to Sweden. Well, if the old bones roll, God rest his soul.
Well, thanks to Stephen Scobie for those readings. And we'll finish off this podcast with a few words from Kate Clancy and Robert Crawford when they were asked to say what they thought of Stanza by Peggy Hughes.
I think Stanza's a great national institution. It's obviously a wonderful festival. It's perhaps a shame that it's Scotland's only real poetry festival. Scotland has a lot of literature festivals, but I don't think there are a lot of poetry festivals.
You think there should be more?
So thank God we have Stanza. And there should either be more, or Stanza should just be beamed out across the country in an obligatory way. Yeah.
So we should just herd people into church halls and have them listen to poetry. Yes.
pay to get out. Yeah,
absolutely. And
kids. Yeah, no, I want it to grow and grow. I love coming to Stanza. I've had a wonderful time.
Good.
And Andrew's been looking so beautiful.
The weather's been great. Yeah. It has been. We've been fortunate. Uh-huh. And the homecoming theme, you think you've fit into that well?
I'm interested in it. I'm interested in all the very many issues. Every time I come up to Scotland, I always think about being Scottish and not being Scottish.
No, I enjoyed your thing today.
It's quite a powerful theme for me, really. Yeah.
Good. Great.
Yeah. I've just come home today. I've just sort of come off the train from London earlier this evening, so it's good to be home. Yes.
Well, thanks, Kate and Robert and everyone who's taken part in this podcast. As you can hear, it's quite an effervescent and lively atmosphere at the bar where that interview was conducted. My name is Colin Fraser. I'm the presenter and producer of these podcasts. And thanks to everyone who's contributed, including Ewan McLean, who provided the music at the beginning, and to Jill Bowman, who provides the music as we end. We'll be back tomorrow with another podcast. Hope to hear from you then. Bye-bye.